Good morning and welcome to the May session of the Nebraska Court of Appeals. I'm Frankie Moore and I'm in my office in North Platte appearing via WebEx, as we all are. And I'm pleased to be joined by our Chief Judge Mike Pirtle from Omaha and Judge Rico Bishop in Lincoln. I will remind counsel that we are live streaming the arguments on NET and they will be archived for viewing on our website. So if you have any sensitive or confidential information, please keep that in mind. And I know we've already tested the system and everyone so far is able to hear and see. So with that, we will go ahead and Mr. Copley, you may begin.
Thank you very much. May it please the court. My name is Brian Copley. I'm appearing today on behalf of the appellant, Daryl Nelson. As the court's aware, we've made two assignments of error, and I'm gonna start with the first assignment of error, and that's in regards to the common law marriage issue. The district court found that a common law marriage existed from my client and the appellee's relationship in Colorado in July of 1997. We're asking the court to modify that order to find that the actual marriage date was July 17th, 2011. This is somewhat of an interesting case because, as this court's probably aware, there's been some new case law that's come down in Colorado. This new case law, I think I want to start with that first. What to me it really did was clarify the seminal case in Colorado, which is People v. Lucero, which is covered extensively in the brief and the district court's order. And I'll kind of quote from that case. That's N. Ray Eddie Hogsett v. Neal. They stated that they're retaining the core parts of Lucero, which is the centrality of mutual consent and some manifestation of that conduct. But I think also they kind of tied in an overarching theme, which is that you got to do a flexible inquiry into the totality of the circumstances, and that there must be some evidence of subsequent conduct.
Excuse me, Mr. Copley, before you go further, I know the case you're speaking of was decided in January of this year, and was after the district court's decision in our case. So do you think we apply the new case law or the Lucero case?
I believe that based on my review of Hogsett that you would apply to that case because it's really just clarifying what they had already decided in Lucero. And they were trying to adapt it to the change, obviously, as the court may be aware, in life circumstances, I guess, since Lucero. And so they were basically applying this extra test of totality of circumstances because not every marriage, not every relationship is the same. And so in my opinion that we could still apply Hogsett because it's clarifying what the main principles are of Lucero. And so I'd like to actually go through the two prongs that are set forth in Hogsett, but also Lucero, and those are mutual consent and then additionally subsequent conduct that's the manifestation of that consent. And so in the case at hand in regards to mutual consent, if you look at the district court finding that the marriage existed as of July 1997, that would mean that my client had cohabitated for about late 1996 to July 97. So it could be anywhere from 6 to 9 months. They had not cohabitated for very long. In regards to mutual consent, they testified they'd got the application, but they never completed the process. My client testified he got cold feet. He felt that he was too young. Mind you, he was only 19 years old at that time. And he felt there was not a big pressure to do it. He said he got a promise ring. She called it an engagement ring. So there's no testimony that it was, in fact, a wedding ring. And I think if you look at the mutual consent portion of this, the fact is they never turned in the application. They never followed through with the process. They never had a ceremony. I'll be honest. Yes.
What's the earliest point at which they started referring to each other as husband and wife?
The testimony from trial from the lower court was a little unclear on that. All he says is that he did call her his wife. And there was testimony. I'm not sure there's a date tied to that. We're looking at this about 23 years later. I'm sorry. Is there a question?
No, sorry. It sounds like we have a little delay.
Okay.
So, Mr. Copley, we're
some of the issue was we were looking at this.
Counsel, was your client and the appellee holding themselves out as husband and wife to the public though?
The appellant stated at court that he had called her his wife. And so that's the testimony. There was no third party evidence from anybody in Colorado that they had held themselves out, I guess, to the public. But he had admitted that he had called her his wife to other people, I believe. So, yes, and in fact, he had said that he had admitted that, Your Honor.
And then we also had the cross stitch wall hanging that his grandmother had given them, and it was displayed prominently, as I understand it, on a living room wall for a number of years.
Yes, there is the cross stitch. That's something that, in fact, my client's grandma had prepared. And so I'm not sure what, I can't recall. I don't believe there was ever clear evidence as to when that was prepared. Certainly the client's grandma wanted to consider their relationship as being a marriage as of July of 1997. But I do think that meeting that first prong is really difficult still because he didn't admit himself that he had actually got married. He got cold feet and then he felt there wasn't a big pressure to do it.
Is that a question of fact for the trial court then, whether his testimony is believable?
I understand the district court pointed out that he found the credibility issues, but I do want to at least say this about my client is he could have gone into court and suggested that he didn't call her his wife. He could have suggested that, that in fact, I mean, it felt as though, and then also there's a portion of that where he says, I did intend to get married. I did intend to follow through with it. So I understand that's within the province of the trial court, but I wanted to point out that there were some areas here where my client was pretty credible about being honest about his relationship with his wife. If I could, I'd like to move to the subsequent conduct portion of this. They had, as I said, cohabitated for about 6 to 9 months as of the date of marriage. They were only in Colorado for about 21 months. And so as far as subsequent conduct, you have cohabitation and you have characterization of each other as husband and wife, but there was no surnames. There were no joint bank accounts, no joint property, no joint tax returns, no children. I understand some of that's because they were pretty young, but there was none of this additional conduct that we look at in Lucero and as referenced in Hogsett that is kind of necessary to establish this. And we believe that was an abuse of discretion to find that there was this common law marriage based on that. And I want to touch on Hogsett again, because in Hogsett, there had been an exchange of rings at a ceremony in front of people at a bar. And they found that this was evidence of a committed relationship, but not a marriage. In a companion case, Beasley Slave Yukin, 2021, Colorado 2, there was evidence that the husband gave wife a wedding ring, said the pair could be husband and wife if she agreed, but there was no ceremony. She had agreed and she had wore the ring, but the Colorado Supreme Court remanded it to the district court because they felt the magistrate's findings were ambiguous about whether there was mutual consent. So I think that stands for the principle that they were placing a somewhat high burden here on whether you can actually show mutual consent. If you exchange rings in front of people at a bar, or you hand a ring to someone and say, we want to be married if you agree, and they still found that that was insufficient evidence. And we believe that based on what the pool of exceptions, as you guys will review it, there simply was not sufficient evidence of this marriage. There is one case from Nebraska, Spitz v. Teal Haas Tires, the court's aware. In that case, there are some distinguishing facts. There was 8 years of cohabitation. They had a child together, and there was a wedding ring. So those would be factors that are different than my case and probably lean toward more of a common law marriage. But they had not called each other husband and wife. So that's another factor that's different than ours. But in that case, the Supreme Court had affirmed the decision that there was not a common law marriage.
May I ask you a question, Mr. Copley?
Sure.
So I realize the parties didn't live in Colorado very long after obtaining the marriage license. Do we consider their conduct in Nebraska thereafter in our analysis? And I'm thinking of the fact that they continued to cohabitate and they also filed joint tax returns as a married couple before the official ceremony in 2011.
Right. My position, our position is that we would not consider any of the conduct in Nebraska because we simply do not recognize common law marriage. And so we are looking at all the conduct that occurred for this brief amount of time in Colorado to determine whether the common law marriage existed. Now, it was always our bone of contention that there simply was not enough time and not enough conduct that would justify calling it a common law marriage. I think it sets a dangerous precedent in a neighboring state for that. I mean, it's someone could move there and live there very briefly and almost establish a common law marriage based on some of the evidence here. I know I'm almost running out of time. I did make a second assignment of error in regards to alimony. And I think it's laid out pretty good in the brief about as far as we think Haluska is probably the best, the most comparable case. We think the primary purpose was to equalize income, and we would like, and we believe that that also, that alimony amount should be modified, Your Honors.
Thank you very much, Mr. McMillan, when you're ready.
Thank you. Please recognize the appearance of Mark McMillan, appearing on behalf of the defendant appellee, Elizabeth Richardson Nelson. Initially, I want to address the question that was raised relating to continuing conduct in Nebraska. Certainly recognizing that the duration of the time spent in Colorado was short, but I think Lucero does indicate that there is no time element that relates to the intent of the parties when it comes to marriage. I think in this particular case, however, the conduct of the parties after they moved to Nebraska is pretty central to the case. I think it probably establishes, well, it definitely establishes that the parties were holding themselves out as married at the time they moved to Nebraska. The court, when it looked at the facts in the case, considered about 10 items. The items that it considered was the starting date of the parties when they got together was in approximately 1996. The interesting part too then is the court also considered the trip to the county clerk in Denver, Colorado, which was the July 17, 1997 date. I think, however, and that's also pointed out and included in the cross stitch that was displayed in the party's living room for a number of years. One thing that the court did also look at was that there basically was testimony that there were no joint accounts in the state of Colorado. However, there was testimony from both parties that there was agreements relating to division of bills, payment of expenses, those kinds of things. That was relied upon by the court. The other interesting aspect of the common law marriage recognition that was determined by the court, by Judge Doyle, was that Darrell had purchased a ring. He called it a promise ring. I don't believe that was what my client had considered it. That was prior to the move to Nebraska. Then Mr. Nelson indicated he purchased a ring after moving to Nebraska. Elizabeth testified that she believed they were married in 1997, that the trip to the county clerk was in fact the manifestation of that. Yes.
Does it make any difference that, you know, they talked about the marriage, they got the license in 1997, they're in Colorado, he decides against it, and then they moved to Nebraska in 1998. So they really haven't lived together in Colorado for what, maybe a year, 2 years, when they come to Nebraska where common law marriage isn't recognized. Does that timing make a difference? The fact that they were in Colorado for such a limited period of time?
And I did actually look at that issue prior to the arguments today. I believe it's the Lucero case that says that there is no duration requirement when it comes to the determination of common law marriage. I don't know if the Mockstead case addressed that at all or not, but I didn't look at that issue in that framework. But The other part that is interesting is that the evidence relating to whether the parties were holding themselves out of marriage all comes from Daryl's family. It would be Daryl's, I believe, uncle that testified that when they moved to Nebraska, immediately, shortly after moving to Nebraska, that that Uncle Donald was, that my client was introduced to Uncle Donald, who is Daryl's uncle, as my wife. That was the statement from Uncle Donald, that she was introduced, my client was introduced as the wife. So, you know, we've got the behavior, we've got, I believe, the intent certainly is there from the perspective of the parties that they were intending to be married in Colorado. That, and unfortunately, because the tax records can only go back to 2008, it started in 2008 with joint tax return filings, and those were identified as husband and wife filing jointly, and that was only transcripts that were available from the IRS. Were no tax returns, no other documents, no other like lease agreements, anything like that from Colorado. Unfortunately, because of the longevity of the relationship.
Mr. McKeown, did your client testify at all about not taking the surname after the 97 certificate?
I don't recall if she did or not, and I did not look at that issue during my preparation as far as the brief and those kinds of things. I think because of the children, if I recall correctly, because of the children, she wanted to maintain the her maiden name as well as the appellant's surname as well. So the other thing that was strikingly evident at the time of trial was when Mr. Nelson was asked about the children, he testified from day one, he considered the children to be his children. That's, there's, I believe, six children combined. Mr. Nelson had one child, and my client had five children, and he indicated during testimony that those are my children, so and inclusive of all of the children. And again, the other part of it is the cross stitch, which was actually prepared by Daryl's grandmother, and that cross stitch had the date, the July 17, 1997 date on it. Looked like a man and wife in wedding attire, holding a bouquet, the wife holding a bouquet. Does say united in love and addresses the date. So,
but the analysis isn't based on necessarily that a relative maybe really wanted that marriage to have occurred, and the fact that the parties may have decided not to doesn't change the fact that the relative may still want to encourage that by going ahead and sharing the cross stitch that was done. So I guess I'm hesitant to put too much weight on the cross stitch.
I suppose that's a possibility. I do think, however, the Judge Doyle did take into consideration the demeanor of the parties during the testimony, and felt that observance of the party's behavior and answers and credibility weighed heavily in favor of my client, Elizabeth. I think as a result, and applying the law, the case of Lucero, which was the intent of the parties, it certainly appeared from all of that, I believe, correctly determined by Judge Doyle that there was a common law marriage in Colorado.
And I presume the primary dispute at trial was what the date of the marriage was for purposes of determining duration of alimony here.
Yeah, that's really what it boiled down to. And I think the abuse of discretion argument comes from finding the parties were married in 1997 rather than the later date in Nebraska, and certainly that makes a great amount of difference in the duration of marriage.
So how do you respond to Mr. Copley's position in his brief that your client is capable of earning more money? She has her CNA. She could renew her license with fairly minimal investment and could make more money. It seems to me that we have a lot of case law out there that says, you know, you can't intentionally reduce your income just because you prefer doing something else for purposes of deciding things like child support and alimony anyway.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think this is a situation where it had shifted over a period of time. It wasn't just a circumstance where my client had stopped doing work as a CNA or those kinds of things. I think as the wage earning capacity shifted between parties, that had happened over a period of time. And Mr. Nelson was actually earning a substantial amount of money more than my client after he got hired by Parker Hannifin. So it would happen. I just don't think if he was really planning on looking at this from an alimony aspect. She did not stop doing the things she had been doing in order to increase her ability to be awarded alimony.
Thank you, Mr. McKeown. You are out of time now, and I believe Mr. Copley is also out of time. So that will conclude our arguments today. I appreciate your appearance today via WebEx. Your case is submitted, and you are excused.
Thank you both.
Thank you both.